I'd just like to welcome everybody to our webinar tonight. This webinar is on collaborative care for children with an autism spectrum disorder. It's an interdisciplinary panel discussion. The webinar is presented by MHPN, and the panel tonight is Dr. John Ray, Associate Professor Cheryl Disanayake, Professor Sylvia Roger, and Professor Andrew Cashin. I'm your facilitator, Dr. Michael Murray. And just to inform you that Dr. John Ray has been unable to we've been unable to get video to him tonight, so he will just be coming in on audio. This webinar is hosted by MHPN. It's a Commonwealth-funded project supporting the development of sustainable interdisciplinary collaboration in the local primary mental health sector across Australia. We currently support over 450 local interdisciplinary mental health networks. For more information or to join a local network, visit www.mhpn.org.au. We have three learning objectives tonight. At the end of the session, participants will be able to better understand the key principles of intervention and the roles of different disciplines in providing collaborative care to children with an autistic spectrum disorder and their families. Recognize the mental health risks for children with an autism spectrum disorder and their families, and better understand the merits, challenges, and opportunities in providing collaborative care to children with an autism spectrum disorder and their families. To find out more about your own individual CPD recognition, please visit mhpn.org.au. I will just give you the session outline. The webinar is comprised of two parts: a facilitated interdisciplinary panel discussion, and then question and answers fielded from the audience. There are a number of ground rules. I will moderate the panel discussion, and I will also, on your behalf, put questions to the panel. You can submit questions for the panel by typing them in the message box to the right-hand side of your screen. You can also minimize the text box if you're finding it distracting using the arrows above and beside the box. If your specific question is not addressed, or if you want to continue the discussion, feel free to participate in a post-webinar online forum on MHPN online. If you require technical support during the evening, please call 1-800-733-416. 1-800-733-416. Please ensure that your sound is on and the volume is turned up on your computer. If you're having bandwidth issues, sound or internet lagging or dropping out, you can minimize this by clicking on the presenters' webcams and pressing the pause button under their video screen. You will still be able to hear the presenters when you pause their webcams. Webinar recording and PowerPoint slides will be posted on MHPN's website within 48 hours of the live activity. For further technical support, please call 1-800-733-416. Now, I'm just going to ask you, John, to present your perspective as a pediatrician. John is speaking to us from Western Australia, and unfortunately, his broadband has dropped out. We've been having broadband problems over the last few days in the region. John, I have your first slide up.
Thanks very much, Michael, and good evening to everybody. This child, Jamie, at 3.5 years of age, is showing fairly obvious features of autism spectrum disorder, with some difficulties in communication, socialization, and some unusual behaviors, so the classic triad of autism. Just to go over some of the points there, he's been described as not responding to direct and simple commands. He is a loner and seems to wander around, having difficulty settling for long play activities. He seems to seems to show some preference for certain toys and activities, and we wonder here how repetitively he's playing with those matters. He's also showing some sensory sensitivities and has developed preferences for certain clothes. And in the final paragraph, a message also about language development, that the mother describes as not being as comprehensive as the older daughters at a similar age. So these are the combined features of communication, socialization, and some unusual behaviors and interests. The major differential diagnosis, though, as a pediatrician that I would be considering are a global developmental delay, where there is delays in all aspects of development, or of specific delays in language development, plus perhaps some social anxiety. However, that's the combination of features that makes us think of an autism spectrum disorder. One could look quite quickly, though, at the matter of global developmental delay by undertaking a simple developmental screen, such as the Ages and Stages questionnaire. And I know that this screen in particular is rolled out in some general practitioners around the country and is a common tool used by pediatricians now. So these features, though, of autism, if we can consider that global delay has been considered, need to be explained to the family, and we could indicate at this stage, because there's clearly an undercurrent of dramatic concern and anxiety here, that the outcomes are variable but can be very good, and I think that's important news for this family in particular. I'd also note in the immediate presentation that Jamie has some quite significant behavioural and sleep problems that are immediately impacting on the family, and these could get more immediate attention. And next slide, please, Michael. I, as a paediatrician, would now be proceeding in a couple of ways. I have access through the Medicare Initiative for Children with Autism to some diagnostic or workup codes for children with these features. So using those codes, I would refer to psychology and speech pathology colleagues. And in this regard, I personally work within a close network of professionals who are scattered around the metropolitan area, so that I have all regions covered, if you like, who would be able to respond and who have been proven to network well with me and to demonstrate good communication and who I could trust with the assessment workup. In addition, I could access other Medicare codes if necessary to refer for some immediate behavioural and social support. And in this regard, liaison with the GP might be particularly important to look at mum's mental health needs. Personally, I would also want to catch up with the father with the case as presented, who has other broader concerns typically held by fathers. And, of course, that's if he wasn't actually there at the first paediatrics appointment. I'd be making a deliberate attempt to follow up with Dad. At this stage, it's also reasonable to give the family some further resources to appropriate websites or written materials. Such resources, I think, the majority of paediatricians have at hand these days. So that's the way I would be proceeding at this stage. In greater detail, the further assessment by a paediatrician may include a broad developmental assessment, and then the use of the paediatrician may continue to be involved in more autism-specific assessment tools. The paediatrician is often the professional who will case manage, in a sense, that other matters such as hearing and vision have been considered, and it's the paediatrician who may also post-diagnosis, or even at this stage of workup, may consider other biological investigations as directed by the detailed history and examination. So a number of elements, Michael, that the paediatrician would be thinking of and proceeding with from that initial presentation. And I hope been able to see the way in which communication with the relevant professionals is important in this regard. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much, John. That was a very good presentation. Now, Cheryl, we'll just move on to you.
Thank you, Michael. Hello, everyone. This is my first webinar, so this is a learning curve for me. Now, just in beginning, I guess I'd like to say, as mental health professionals, as far as possible, I think we really need to work, when we're working with young children, we need to work within a framework of prevention science, where in the absence of known biological causes and cures for autism spectrum disorders, I think our best approach is to minimize the effects of these disorders on the developing child. And we can do this first by identifying these children early, and second, by intervening as soon as there are warning signs. So I would really hasten to, you know, tell people to act now, act quickly, don't put things off. And in Jamie, the warning signs are as follows. I've put them on this slide. And unfortunately, from the case notes, it appears that these signs have been around for some time. They've been noted by the childcare staff for over a year. And the areas of concern, John's gone through them, I've simply set them out under the difficulties in social interaction and reciprocity that we're seeing from the case study, and also difficulty in language and communication. And then on the next slide, areas which I think fit in under sort of the restricted and repetitive interests that, you know, really raise concerns around autism, that across these three areas there are some concerns with Jamie. And I've also noted here some sensory features that, you know, have been highlighted. Other areas of concern here is that Jamie doesn't sleep very well at night, and this is not uncommon in autism spectrum disorders. And there are some concerns surrounding the parents, including risks for mental health problems surfacing in mum. There's some indications here in the case study. And the negation of issues by dad, which, as John said earlier, are not uncommon. We quite frequently see these. In terms of then assessments, you know, I would very quickly, you know, look to undertaking an autism assessment of this child just because of the presenting behaviors. And so the assessments I would do is, initially I would talk with the family, and I'm assuming that I would also obtain some of this information from the pediatrician, especially around the medical background of the child, but I'd really want to establish the child's developmental history as well as the family background. In talking about family background, I'm not just talking here about socioeconomic factors, but also familial aspects of developmental issues, as ASDs are a complex set of highly genetic conditions. So I'd really be looking at, you know, are there any other relatives in the family, are any other members of the family affected with any developmental disorders? I would then, having got this background, use something like the social communication questionnaire to see whether there are signs of autism that Jamie is showing in everyday life from his parents' perspective. You can also do something like the autism diagnostic interview. That's a much longer and more detailed interview. So I think in the first instance I'd use something like the social communication questionnaire. Next, I would undertake a developmental assessment to ascertain Jamie's level of functioning, whether, you know, what his cognitive profile looks like, whether he seems to be within the normal range of cognitive ability, or whether there's sort of associated intellectual disability. And then I would conduct a detailed behavioral assessment, given that Jamie's presenting behaviors fall within the three areas of concern for autism spectrum disorders. So in this case, I would use something like the autism diagnostic observation schedule, which is a behavioral assessment of the child. As mums also presenting with some issues, such as sleep difficulties, of course these sleep difficulties may be related to Jamie's poor sleep, which clearly need some behavioral management very soon. But she's also presenting with migraines and loss of appetite, and this is why I would use something like an instrument like the Depression, Anxiety, and Stress Scale to determine if she's clinically anxious and or depressed. So this is really looking across the board at the child and the parents. Now, from my assessments then, if Jamie does indeed meet criteria for an autism spectrum disorder on the basis of these assessments, I guess these are the following referrals I would make to undertake a sort of make sure we get an assessment from a multidisciplinary perspective to confirm a diagnosis of an autism spectrum disorder. And so I would refer to a speech pathologist, an occupational therapist, and most importantly to an early intervention service provider if it looks like this child does indeed have an autism spectrum disorder. I would also refer the family to give them some autism-specific information. I'd certainly refer them to the Peak Autism Body in the state so that they can access an autism advisor, and then I would talk about the HECWA package that's available and some of the resources that are available to that family free of charge. And certainly I would be looking at if mum's coming up, as depressed and anxious, also refer for some psych counselling at this stage. Now, I just want to finish off by saying that Jamie is a little old here. I mean, I know he's just 3.5, but I'd like to highlight that with younger children, it's actually possible to target the developmental antecedents of autism spectrum disorders in early intervention prior to the full-blown syndrome being apparent. And this is why I think it's a real pity that his parents have been avoiding the issues because, we now know good evidence-based and contextually relevant early interventions can target risk and protective factors, which in some circumstances really can serve to prevent the full-blown manifestations of autism from developing. So by identifying risk processes early and targeting them in intervention, we now believe that it's actually possible to forestall the development of the full syndrome in at least some children. So, for example, by forcing attention to critical social stimuli and by promoting the reward value of social engagement and preventing the onset of challenging behaviors before they set in, we believe that it's possible to promote better developmental outcomes. And so what I mean here is that early on it appears possible to put into place the necessary affective and cognitive building blocks to enable more typical development in these children. And I refer in this slide to a review by Molly Helt and her colleagues who've charted cases of what they refer to as optimal outcome. And one of the predictors of so-called optimal outcomes is early identification and behavioral treatment. And interestingly, overall symptom severity was not a predictor of optimal outcome in the cases of autism that they looked at. So there's really every good reason to identify as early as possible and to intervene, to refer these children to appropriate interventions. And really, this is how you can change the futures of children with an ASD and their parents as well, as what you're doing is you're reducing the mental health issues by relieving the stress on the family by promoting positive developmental outcomes in the child by referring early. So I think as mental health practitioners, it's really important to deal also with the grief that a diagnosis may bring in a timely way. Mm. And by helping to source appropriate intervention for the child and also sourcing some family supports, you really can promote better mental health outcomes. And I think we currently don't do this at all well. And we do know from research that parents report less stress and greater acceptance of their child's diagnosis if this happens early and if the child's able to receive appropriate services in a timely way. So I think by acting very quickly, there's a lot we can do for the child and the family. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. That was a very, very complete presentation. Thank you very much. So now we've heard from John Ray, our pediatrician, and we've heard from Cheryl Dufnaiki, our psychologist. We'll now move on to Sylvia Roger, our occupational therapist. I'll just move the slide on for you, Sylvia.
Thanks, Michael. Good evening, everybody. I guess in following up from John and Cheryl, just to kind of focus a little bit on the occupational therapist perspective, the two key things that OTs focus on are enabling individuals, so in this case, Jamie, participation in his meaningful life roles. And we would see these at his age of 3.5 as being his role as a learner in the childcare kindergarten environment, his role as a player, a friend, a playmate, a sibling, and his role as somebody who's developing self-care skills, albeit still fairly dependent, but that a really important childhood role is to, over time, develop independence in eating and feeding and toileting and so forth. And we need to know that those things become really important in going to school and growing up and being like other kids. So our key focus then is to optimise children's performance of these daily occupations or activities such as self-care, school learning, play, and their social participation with other children. And from what Cheryl and John have been describing, in Jamie's case, we can already see that a number of these things are being implicated in Jamie's situation, and that ASDs do affect children's everyday performance, and indeed can cause quite a few difficulties for the family in managing the child every day. So our key aims would be to assist a child such as Jamie to overcome these challenges with their daily activities like dressing, toileting, play, participation in the peer group at school. And we'd certainly be wanting to work very closely with other team members such as the speech therapist, the psychologist, and the early intervention teachers or the people specifically at Jamie's daycare. So very much looking at a team approach and trying not to replicate or duplicate what's already happening, but make sure the best person is engaged with the child at any one point in time. An additional area that occupational therapists may well engage in is to address some of the sensory sensitivities and processing issues that many children with autism, not all, but many children experience, especially in the early years, and to help with any motor coordination difficulties that they might have, and to reinforce any intervention that's already occurring in terms of their behaviour. So not just in terms of behaviour in terms of their unwillingness to do certain things or their rigidity, but things just like in-seat, on-task, sharing, taking turns, the sorts of everyday behaviours that we expect of children in a childcare setting. And the other key thing is that occupational therapists use these everyday activities as the focus of their intervention, but we'll also look at ways that we might change or modify or grade or adapt these activities to make them easier for the child, or how we might indeed work with the environment, with the childcare centre at home, in the community where the child is in fact having difficulties coping. So a really careful assessment of the environment and how that impacts on a child's everyday functioning will be important as well. So in terms of the stage of information gathering or the assessment, again, we'd be really careful not to duplicate things that have already been done, because the worst thing for parents and for a youngster like Jamie is to put them through yet another assessment that may not be needed. But I think we need to be really careful here about the sorts of assessments that are needed to support a diagnosis of autism, and then the type of assessment that's needed to inform intervention. And these are not necessarily the same. The ones that support diagnosis do just that, and then when we look at how do we support intervention and what goals we might start working on with the child and family, these are often a slightly different type of assessment that's needed. So Cheryl already mentioned a need to look at the child's general developmental abilities, as did John. Again, this may or may not have been done. If it hasn't been thoroughly done, there are a number of standardised assessments that occupational therapists might do to get a good sense of the child's general developmental and adaptive abilities. And then we would look specifically at the child's abilities in play, in self-care, and the sorts of underpinning skills they need for learning at kindergarten, and how they function, how they perform these sorts of things every day. And we might then look at underlying capacities that might impact on this performance. So the sensory issues, their motor skills, and their perceptual and cognitive skills that might impact. But again, where assessments have already been done, it's really important that we collaborate, we draw on these, we talk to the people who've done them so that duplication doesn't occur. In terms of just talking a little bit more about this important assessment and goal setting phase, many of the children, especially at Jamie's age, don't cope well with standardised assessments, so we often rely quite heavily on checklists that might be completed by parents or teachers who know the child in the childcare setting, indeed further interview with parents, and skills behavioural observations, and as much as possible getting out to see the child in their naturalistic context at childcare or kindy at home, so that we can really see what they're doing every day, and we can cue into, you know, whether they're learning through imitation or copying, how much demonstration they need to be able to carry out a task, how they engage with play, toys with other objects, how they interact with peers. So as much as possible to get out of a clinic session setting and see children in their sort of naturalistic everyday environment. I think one thing that's really important is to get a good understanding of the child's interests, what they like and what they dislike. And we can use their likes very much in terms of motivations and rewards as part of intervention, as a way of motivating and engaging them. In the old days, we used to try and diminish children's access to some of their restricted interests for fear that they'll continue to become obsessed by them. But nowadays, we really click into the motivation and engagement that we can work with children if we know that they're doing things that are part of their special interests. So we can renegotiate how those are done. And so finding out what they are and what really engages children is really important. I think the other thing that's important is that the diagnostic assessment process focuses a lot on the child's challenges or the deficits that they have in order to meet various DSM criteria, and that it's really important to be able to also get a good picture of the child's strengths. And our experience working with families soon after diagnosis is that they tend to forget that they have a child who is just like other children in many ways. They have interests and likes, and they have lots of strengths as well. And that just helping parents reinforce the parents what they are can be really helpful. So we'd aim to identify intervention goals with the parents and with other team members. There are a number of tools that have become very widely used now to help do collaborative goal setting with parents and with other members of the team. So we'd really want to make sure that all the people working with Jamie are pulling in the same direction, that we were working on similar priorities, and indeed that we'd be very clear to know what the parents' priorities are and as much as possible to work with those. From a management point of view, an OT would be very keen to try to support Sandra and Justin to manage Jamie at home. We'd be really wanting to try and support or enhance their competence as parents, because often parents feel very distressed that the child doesn't respond to them as their other children do, or other children that they see in other families. And we'd want to try to help them to develop family rituals and routines that are health-giving and support family well-being. We know that many families of children with autism develop quite inflexible, pervasive, rigid routines that are very ASD-centric, particularly at meal times and bedtimes. At times of the day that are really stressful for parents, and that these can pervade the whole household. And there's increasing research evidence to suggest that healthy family routines and rituals that make families feel like they're families, that let them do things in a much more comfortable way, really enhance family well-being. So these parts of the day are really important things to address. We'd aim to be working from a family-centred and strengths-based approach so that we can identify the resources, formal and informal, that parents and families have, and that we can build on those, again, not just focus on the deficits. And as John has already mentioned, and Cheryl, that provision of information continues to be important. And what we see is being really critical is helping parents to individualise that generic web-based information and understand how that impacts on them and how these things play out in their child and their child's everyday functioning. And just being able to do that often helps them reframe the issues that their child has and understand them better and helps them to explain those things to grandparents and other important people in their lives. From the perspective of working with Jamie himself, whether that be in the early intervention or childcare setting or in a separate clinic setting, we'd aim to work with social play and cognitive play skills to support the child's development of more mature forms of play. That might be through modelling or imitation or demonstration, or indeed helping parents and siblings play in an engaging and appropriate way with the child. We'd also look to develop fine and gross motor skills where these are found to be wanting, and to work with the other team members to support the child's social interaction in an appropriate way with therapists, peers, and other family members. Self-care skills I've mentioned already as being pretty important. So we'd look at helping the child to acquire some of the skills that are important in everyday dressing and eating and toileting, adapting the task as necessary or the equipment that's used in those self-care skill development or the environment where these things occur. Helping the child transition through the day through using visual supports and schedules, and again helping the family to develop routines that are functional and relatively stress-free are also important. And finally, although Jamie is only 3.5, it's never too young to start helping the parents and the child to develop some self-regulation strategies. And that might be to adapt or modify the environment to support their performance, to help them with sensory overwhelm where this is experienced every day, or to help the parent manage that so that over time, as little ears get older, that they develop their own self-regulation strategies. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sylvia. Sorry, we're just having a minor tech glitch here. We're just all back online again. I'd now like to thank you very much for that very complete presentation, Sylvia. We'll now move on to the mental health nurse perspective, Professor Andrew Cashin. Andrew, over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
I'll just move this slide on.
Yeah, thank you. I'm only going to present two slides, and I always find talking in 5 minutes a relative challenge, so I'll try to unpack them as much as I can within the 2 minutes. I guess part of the aim to talk about the key principles of intervention and then what disciplines can offer are fairly well integrated in that we often bring a fairly discipline-specific vision to interventions. The good news about the key principles in autism is that what we know is that whether you have a diagnosis of Asperger's disorder or autistic disorder, there's the common triad of impairment. I think in terms of mental health nursing, the more informative position beyond the behavioural triad is perhaps the cognitive processing triad. And in the similarities we hear in intervention across all the disciplines that have been presented, is that there has to be some falling back to understanding the way of being in the world that's autism. And of course, that's underlined by the key triad, which is impaired linguistic processing, impaired abstraction, impaired theory of mind. And they're the things that are outwardly presented in the behavioural triad. Even the debates that we see by Lorna Wing and others about what might emerge in the next version of the DSM and as to whether that point of the triad of over-regulated behaviour, of repetitive activity, is any longer needed or would impaired imagination perhaps be a better descriptor.
Andrew, may I just ask you to speak up a little bit, please? It's just a little bit difficult to hear you. That's fine.
Yeah, certainly. the sort of underpinning notion of impaired abstraction is a good explanatory point. I guess, why do I go to that? Well, the principles that unify all the discussions so far, and I don't need to repeat them in terms of how to support someone in a family and strategies, is based on understanding that thinking and information processing style. What role would a mental health nurse take? Well, at the first point of the, and what we've led into with our case study is the question of diagnosis. And mental health nurses are able to make a diagnosis and name entities such as autistic disorder, Asperger's disorder. I guess the underlying principle, though, is diagnosis has to be collaborative, and part of that collaboration is the parents. Thinking very much what we're hearing about naturalistic assessment, the impaired abstraction leads to context-specific behaviour, and so one of the principles of diagnosis is to get as many behavioural descriptors in as many contexts as possible. So mental health nurses are well-placed to get involved in doing things such as going to the preschool and meeting with the parents and the preschool staff with that curious question of what's going on in terms of behaviour, using standardised tools such as the Gilliam Autism Rating Scale as a way of structuring a conversation of how this little person might be behaving at home and at preschool. Involving dad in the early discussion so that mum and dad are coming to the same conclusions as really useful as possible. What often happens is that mum actually has to then translate the health provider's world to dad at home, and that comes with all sorts of stresses. So if we can involve dad at that very first point, that's wonderful. Of course, we need referral, as we've said, the principles are all the same. We need to check whether they're in a probabilistic statement, such as diagnosis, as to whether there's a contributor or even a better reason, such as hearing, a good physical check. We also need to begin to think about the degree of comorbid intellectual delay. So moving then on beyond diagnosis, and I guess we get more chance to explore that. What would a mental health nurse do? Mental health nurses are well placed to do therapy with individuals, couples, families, and with larger support groups. At a 3.5-year-old with someone with autism, a lot of the work's about structuring the environment around that person. So it's about working with the family to understand how this little person processes information, and so that they can work with that person to form more functional routines. Looking at sleep, for instance, with a positive behaviour support approach of thinking about what's the hypothesis, why is sleep an issue, and you can really work with people if they understand the thinking and processing style to work on those routines. Same with things like play at preschool. Involving the preschool staff in the discussion of what might be a plausible cause for the behaviour can remove a lot of parent blaming, and it can also help lead to a greater ability to keep the child in that context when staff know that there are interventions that may make a difference. And if we get to a good description of what's happening, they may actually find that they're quite able to be a lot more potent in terms of getting this little person to follow instructions and do the things they need. Intervention, of course, for social skills, using things like social stories is informed by that information processing. So, interestingly, and we'll get to a discussion later, these are lifelong impairments, so impaired theory of mind doesn't go away. We've found no way to teach theory of mind. And so mental health nurses are well placed by the time this person gets to around 10 to start working with them on developing their own ability to form new functional routines through talking therapies. And that's really important so people don't get learned hopelessness and drift into depression. The other thing about is that working with extended family is how do you build systems around to support the family? Often with autism, there's judgments as why isn't your child behaving, and so you can find grandparents and parents start to disagree on what might be happening, and the situational supports for the person drop off. Mental health nurses are well placed to work within that broader context. And to then empower extended family to remain engaged as situational support. This is really important when we think about the long-term mental health risks for the family. One thing that does happen in families is that over-regulation actually pervades the family system, and we know that, and this is a really common sense thing, we might get a chance to talk about it in the discussion, But a child that has overregulated behaviour, it often becomes easier to keep that child at home, or they're excluded from other things, and we see the risk here of exclusion from preschool. The easiest way to manage the child at home is often to develop a routine, and the family becomes overregulated and, of course, has the risk of losing resilience. And so getting a broad support around the family means that there can be plenty of space for healthy respite. And whilst the person with autism may benefit from an overregulated environment to a degree, his sister may well not. And so there needs to be time for quality time spent with the sister. One more thing before I sort of sign off. Mental health nurses are well placed to also work with the sister. And of course, Carol Gray, you know, and developed the Sixth Sense program. But there's lots of ways to work with an 8-year-old as well to start to examine issues of why their sibling behaves differently. And importantly, at that age of 8, also why mum and dad might react and treat the sibling differently and might respond to behaviours that this 8-year-old would himself get in trouble for. So all of these things are things that mental health nurses can do within the principle that anything to be done with autism, the important thing is to understand not only the behavioural triad but the cognitive processing triad, because that informs all of the things the earlier speakers were talking about, particularly some of the things Sylvia was talking about in terms of why you'd use visual supports and the like. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That was a lovely presentation. Just a little bit of housekeeping. There are some noises coming through during some of the presentations. Just please avoid typing any of the presenters during your talks or when you're replying. It does come through the phones, unfortunately. Now, we've had four expert presentations, all of them very complete. And all of them specialist opinions in relation to diagnosis and management. We're now going to move on to the next stage of the webinar where I will ask the panel to ask each other questions initially, and we will let the conversation move on from there. And at times I will come in on behalf of the audience, I will ask questions as well. So I was just wondering, Andrew, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask John, our paediatrician?
I guess the first question I'd be really curious, John, is what role might medication play, do you think, for this little person?
Thanks, Andrew. Well, I guess there's this particular point in time for Jamie, that is at 3.5 years of age, and most doctors would be naturally reluctant to consider prescriptions in a child at this age. But the standout matter at the moment is sleep disturbance, and then there's also the question of whether any medication might be other medication might be considered in behavioural or mental health context at this point. But to focus on sleep, we would want first to rule out any possible organic causes and to review the current management or sleep hygiene that the family have in place for this boy and consider co-sleeping, for example, or of other extraneous noises or stimuli that might be contributing to the boy's sleep disturbance. And a broader sleep history is important in terms of rather than the current descriptor is not sleeping well at night, that's the mum, but also for the boy we would like to know if there are particular disturbances in getting off to sleep or if the disturbance is one of difficulties in staying asleep with multiple nighttime wakings, a common sleep disturbance seen in children with autism, or is one of early waking. So there's a great deal of detail in the sleep history that must be obtained. Ultimately, if that's been undertaken and perhaps some simple sleep remedies have been, behavioural remedies have been considered and implemented, but say if there is ongoing failure of over a reasonable period of time, say an additional month in this child, where sleep has failed to improve through conservative measures, then it would be not uncommon to consider the use of melatonin perhaps as a first agent. Here the thing to say, of course, is that there's lots of bad melatonin, herbal and other homeopathic melatonin that probably that doesn't carry established efficacy. But appropriate melatonin, with consideration of starting at a dose of around 1 milligram, with a review, I often do this part of review by phone call or email every few nights to consider adjusting the dose if necessary, with the aim of achieving onset of sleep within half an hour of dose. And the key thing here is having achieved a reasonable dosage to sleep rate pattern for to consider continuing that often for a 4 to 6 week period in order to reverse the sleep cycle, and then one can usually gently wean off the sedative over an ensuing 2 to 3 week period. An alternative, Andrew, would be here, you know, there are a number of sedatives that could be considered. I personally prefer good old temazepam, considering a small dose of 1.25 milligrams, but would consider going to 2.5 and up to 5 milligrams if necessary to assist with this boy's sleep. But I wanted to emphasise the conservative approach that would be undertaken to start off with. And then I guess to turn very quickly to other behaviours at the moment, I personally would be steering clear of considering other medicational options at this first appointment, but would want to continue to review the matter, but would in general principle be reluctant to consider medications certainly before the age of 4 and mostly before the age of 6. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks very much.
The comment further might come up at later stage. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, no, that's really good, because there were quite a few questions around sleep in this age group. But we must remember, too, that we're talking about children going all the way from the toddler right through to adolescence. So
yeah.
I'd just like to ask Cheryl, are there any questions that you'd like to ask Sylvia, maybe in relation to the older child group?
Yes. Thank you, Michael. I would, I'm sorry, I'm just really getting my questions in mind.
No, that's fine. That's
Sylvia, can we, with very early intervention, do you think we can prevent the onset of sensory issues in autism?
Thanks, Cheryl. I'm not sure that we can prevent the onset of sensory issues, but we could certainly help children and their families manage them better. I like to sort of think about autism as a lifelong disorder, a bit in the way we use in a chronic disease management approach, but obviously disease management is not quite the right word here. We know from accounts of adults with autism, especially their narrative accounts, that often they continue to experience sensory issues into adulthood, although they often develop some strategies to do that a little bit better. So while not all children with autism have sensory sensitivities and sensory preferences, many of them do, and we know that they often have very extreme responses to sensory issues, such as being frightened of hair dryers or hand dryers in public toilets, or nail cutting or hair washing or hair cutting and things like that. So I think that there are lots of things we can do to help parents manage these things that have to happen. At some point in time, children need to have their hair cut and nails cut and things like that. At this point, there is very little evidence to suggest that a straight sensory integration approach is going to make any long-term changes to the child's central nervous system. We know that some sensory input has a short-term calming effect for children, but it doesn't typically have a long-term enduring effect. So often it's much better to look at the child's day, the tasks and activities they need to do, and look at how we support and manage those tasks during the day and how we can make changes in the environment to help the child better. So we also know that behavioural approaches are more effective for children with autism. So simple things like desensitising the child to a trip to the hairdresser, for example. You know, good old find a hairdresser who's likely to be supportive, do the trip, sit in the chair on mum's lap, maybe next time go and put the cape on, maybe next time go and put the cape on and bring the scissors out, have a special toy in the hand, a reward afterwards, etc. But these sorts of routines are often good ways to support the child to do things that they, you know, at some point in time we're going to have to face that the hair needs to be cut, etc. So I think there are lots of things we can do in helping the child and the family manage every day, but the evidence that we can change the central nervous system functioning in a permanent way is just not there yet. And certainly some of the recent research we've done with adolescents around sensory issues, when we get them to describe the things that trouble them in terms of how they manage the sensory world, they really have developed lots of good strategies that they use themselves to manage that. And I think that's what we have to work towards, children who can self-regulate better and who can develop and understand their own bodies and their own strategies to manage these sorts of issues.
Thank you very much. Cheryl, I just want to ask you a question on behalf of our attendees. Adolescence is a tough time for kids. How can we, in a multidisciplinary manner, assist that transition for children with autism, helping their families, helping the child? Could you comment on that, please?
Is the question with regards to transition into adulthood or into adolescence?
No, into adolescence.
Transition into adolescence. Yes, well, transition into adolescence is difficult for anyone. Typically developing kids find this can be a very difficult time. And it can be really heightened in autism. There's huge individual variation in this, however, and the transition again will also be affected by, you know, where at the level of functioning of that individual. So, you know, someone who has sort of severe cognitive impairments, you know, might find that transition much harder than you know a child who is relatively high functioning, maybe someone who, you know, fits the you know the profile of a sort of a more Asperger's profile. So I think the way of working with families here is around the information you have available to them. But once again, I mean, I guess I keep going back to this. There are very strong behavioral strategies that can be used to working with the family and the child. And I think sometimes we can lose sight of the fact that, you know, it's simply a child going into adolescence, and maybe, you know, some of the same sorts of approaches you might use with a typically developing adolescent can also be brought to bear, but also obviously keeping in mind the kind of autism-specific work that you might need to do around that. But, I think it's a very broad question, and I'd want to know about the particular adolescent before you could really answer that in a very meaningful way.
Yes, yes. No, I can certainly hear what you're saying. Andrew, did you have any? I noticed that you moved forward when I asked that question. Do you have anything you'd like to add to that? And may I ask you to speak up a little bit?
Yeah, no, thank you, Michael. No, that was a great answer. I was just particularly interested in transitions. And I guess the underlying principle is that in a social world that's linguistically mediated, such as schools, where at most adolescents, you know, spend a great deal of time, we can expect that the impact of their autism is going to compound what's already a difficult time of transition for all typical kids. And so it's really just that underlying principle is that really thinking about if someone doesn't have theory of mind, for instance, or has an impairment in theory of mind, but they still want to have friends, perhaps that group that Lorna Wing coined, the active but odd group. How do you work with them to form functional routines to make and maintain friendships? And how do you form that sense of confidence that even though you might keep tripping over conventions, that you have some carefully tried and tested strategies to develop new routines so that you can get back on track? And it's really important that we do this work with adolescents, because there's a great risk of people starting to feel very hopeless and withdrawn, and we see that not only are anxiety disorders common in people with autism who are in mainstream school, but so is depression. And so I was leaning forward because I think for all mental health professionals, that's certainly a time to be aware of. And all transition points, and that's one great one, are really worth noting. And I'll give the other panel members a chance now, except for to make the comment that not only do we have a transition from childhood to adolescence, we also go from primary school to secondary school at the same time, just to compound things.
Yes.
And so that's another transition that occurs around the same time, and both of them work together to create a potential minefield of angst.
Thank you very much. John Ray, do you have anything to add to that?
No, look, I think you're really both the family and the child are on this roller coaster ride with typically part of the down ride being at these points of transition into adolescence, certainly into young adulthood, and a number of stages to be negotiated also in adulthood. And these transition times are the major times of mental health touch points. So family are on a roller coaster ride, but importantly, there are a number of professionals who, with good communication skills, can play some significant roles in easing that ride. So that would be the main thing to add, Andrew.
Thank you.
And thank you, Michael.
The other question that was recurring, particularly at the beginning of the webinar, were the issues of, for want of a better word, grief that occurs within the family when the child is noticed to be different, and also in the diagnostic process, and then once diagnosis is made. Sylvie, I was wondering, could you comment on that, please, initially?
Sure. Thanks, Michael. Certainly, quite a lot of the research that we were involved with through the Stronger Families Initiative with FACTIA funding in the mid-2000s was working with parents of newly diagnosed children with autism and trying to facilitate some in-home intervention and strategies from the get-go. And I think, as I mentioned in my presentation, one of the things we really became acutely aware of was the grief that fathers experience. Not to underplay what mothers do by any stretch of the imagination, but they do tend to be the person who is fronting with the child to the GP, the paediatrician, the teacher, the psychologist, the speech therapist, etc. So they immediately get access to information and explanations and start sort of processing this new information little by little. And as John mentioned earlier, it's the dads that are at home who are relying on that filtering of information, and often through, you know, work responsibilities and so forth, don't always have the opportunity to hear the same things firsthand. And so we often see that the process of coming to terms with the fact that their child, often their son, more typically than daughter, is different, the expectations that they hold for that child, becomes something that's often very difficult for them to talk about. And we've certainly found that when we brought parents together in for information and support workshops, that it was the first time the dads had ever had an opportunity to talk to another man, another dad, about what they were going through and what their experiences were with their children. So that I just put a real plug in for professionals to be really conscious of the role of fathers and the fact that they're often under-supported and often miss out on the opportunities that mums do to,
yes,
to hear information and to be able to try and understand it in the context of their childhood and their family.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. That was a very complete answer. Thank you. Unfortunately, the better the webinar, the more interesting the speakers, the quicker the time goes. So, believe it or not, we're nearly at the end of our webinar. The time just seems to have flown tonight. You each have 2 minutes to sum up, and I'm going to be very dictatorial with your time. Cheryl, just 2 minutes of summing up of your thoughts.
In summing up, I've sort of keeping an eye on the questions people have been asking. So I'm going to sort of stick to the questions around early diagnosis. Early diagnosis is possible. The full triad does not have to be present to reliably diagnose a child under the age of three. We do have instruments that are helping us do this, and they're helping us do this reliably. I'm happy for people to contact me about that. In terms of parent mental health issues, we also know that early diagnosis helps with parent mental health issues. While, yes, there's a lot of grief and parents, you know, people, often clinicians say, well, the parent wasn't ready to hear, you know, that the child was developing abnormally. I say to them, parents are never ready to hear that their children are developing abnormally or having a problem. And I think it's very important that we work with the family to help the family to accept that, you know, there are real signs of concern around the child's development, and empower them with the notion that, you know, the earlier we deal with these issues, the smaller the issues are, the easier they are to deal with, and the more effective the ensuing intervention can be. So
thank
I really
you very much, Cheryl. That was lovely. I do like that word, empowerment. Andrew,
okay, thank you.
2 minutes.
Wow, 2 minutes. I can spend 2 minutes talking about the perils of 2 minutes. I think that whilst autism is a different way of being in the world, because 99% of us don't have it, and the strengths that we both, neurotypical and people with autism, possess are quite different, I think that Tony Atwood and Carol Gray in their paper, The Discovery of Aspie, actually highlight it well, is that autism is a very difficult way to exist in a neurotypical world. And so as mental health professionals, I think if we're very mindful of transition points, and we know very quickly that, of course, from early intervention to preschool, from year two to year three, into year five, where girls hit menses and social stuff goes up, then, of course, the anticipation of going to high school and adolescence emerging with all that change and hairy bits, etc., moving into year seven, then year nine, where it becomes a human crime scene of opportunity and motive existing in terms of social stuff, up into year 11 and 12, what comes next. We know all these transition points, and we know that there's a high chance that comorbidity or illness will develop in terms of anxiety, depression, and we know there's an emerging sort of trend of adolescent suicidality and hopelessness that we just need to be aware of mental health professionals, that when someone has autism, that we have a high index of suspicion that these other things may be present, and that we know that to work with someone with autism really requires you to work not only with the person but with their whole context. That's just the things that I sort of would love to jam into 2 minutes.
That's lovely, Andrew. And of course, there is more missed by not asking or looking than not knowing, isn't there? So one must always be suspicious. John, I might ask you to sum up for 2 minutes, please.
Hey, thanks, Michael. I'll try and do it in 30 seconds. I think...
I'm sorry we couldn't get you on video, by the way.
Probably just as well for everybody. Look, I think we've picked up the main points around this being a life journey for family and child. That there, importantly though, the early intervention period, in a sense, is extended in concept. Cheryl sought to emphasise this. That is that the early management of any change in symptomatology and behaviour will lead to better outcomes. So to extend that concept beyond the classic early childhood period, and that there's important opportunities for intervention with multiple disciplines in this disorder, and that can turn around the situation very well in many cases. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John, and thank you very much for your contribution as well. Sylvia, you are going to be able to sum up in 2 minutes.
Thanks, Michael. I guess just to touch on the really important role of collaboration for all people working with these families. We've heard it is a journey, it is a lifelong condition that needs to be managed, and that we do see lots of really very good outcomes when teams work together with families to achieve this. I guess I'd just put in a plug for developmental pediatric services and mental health services to work together and not separately, and for us to be aware of the need to support the mental health needs of children around social anxiety and so forth increasing as they get into school and adolescence. And the mental health of parents are very important. We know they're at risk, and if children have limited communication and challenging behaviours, parents are even more at risk for stress and mental health poor outcomes. So we need to work together across developmental paediatrics, therapy and mental health services to ensure the best quality of life and family health and well-being.
Great. Thank you very much. And one other point that came through on the questions was the difficulties that practitioners and clinicians experience in rural and regional Australia, where they may not have the same services as are available in larger cities. And would anybody like to comment quickly on that, just for maybe 20 seconds?
I think exactly what we're doing here, you know, where using an online resource, I mean, it's not ideal, but, you know, I've just been introduced to Visual Labs, where it's not a webinar like this, but you actually feel like you're in the same room with the person. I really think we need to utilize more and more technologies to do this outreach work for people in rural and remote areas. I think we can do much better than we're currently doing.
Thank you very much. And that leads to my summing up of a very, very informative and enjoyable night. And I think it goes back to what John said initially. We need to, and that would apply to our rural and regional colleagues as well, that networking is really important. It's important if you live in a city. It's important if you live in the country. John mentioned that it's very important to liaise with the general practitioner in relation to mum's mental health needs, because we're looking after a whole family here. Ensuring that the father is involved in the spread of information about the concerns of the treating clinician. And John did mention in the question and answer session the problem of sleep and adopting a conservative attitude towards sleep and not looking at pharmacotherapy, but he illuminated us on some possible pharmacotherapy that can be used. Cheryl endorsed John's triad for diagnosis, the communication, the sociability, and the repetitive sensory problems that these children experience. Always remembering to look at the familial aspects, questioning other members of the family who may have who may fall on the ASD spectrum. The importance of early diagnosis, so that we can put in place risk and prevention processes and strategies. Sylvia then went on to stress the importance of having a meaningful life role, and the importance of ensuring that these children are encouraged to perform the daily occupations that are required within the family setting, and that all management is within the family setting. She stressed the different types of assessments, both diagnostic and those that support intervention, the importance of goal setting for these children, and also encouraging the strengths, and at the same time encouraging hope in the family. Andrew stressed the importance of involving the parents, especially the father. He went over those issues that that John mentioned in relation to the hearing and the physical assessment, and ensuring that there wasn't a more global intellectual delay present. He stressed to support and educate, and the problems that the child typically experiences from the age of 10 onwards with their social skills. The importance of family therapy, which our mental health nurses are very good at practicing, and encouraging positive behaviours both in the child and in the family. This has been a great night. There's been nothing but positive feedback from the participants. I feel very fortunate to be able to sit in on these webinars and to learn so much from our specialist colleagues. And I think we've had four excellent specialist colleagues. And if we could hear the clapping from our participants, I'm sure it would be deafening. Thank you all for coming along tonight, and we look forward to seeing you again. And unfortunately, these nights always go too quickly. I trust we'll all meet again somewhere. Thank you, everybody, for your participation. Please remember to complete the exit survey before you log out. To continue these interdisciplinary discussions, go to the online forum on MHPN online. Remember, visiting mhpn.org.au will get you anywhere you wish in MHPN. The next MHPN webinar is Collaborative Care for Older People with Mental Health Issues. It is on at 7:15 p.m. AEST on Wednesday, the 9th of May, 2012. I would like to wish you all good night, and if you're not at home, a safe journey home. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.